thought today we would do the converse to the Poincaré lemma and the generalized Stokes theorem, which just involves D and wedge, so you know we could do it now. I got it this morning, but I didn't have time to post it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I did look at that.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think I'll do them in the right order this time. We'll see how it all goes. When was it we did that? Was that last summer or summer before?
I think it was 2008.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, I'll start slowly and we'll see if Nathan appears. So, the first thing I want to do is generalize Stokes' theorem. Maybe 2:45 is the way to go. Right. Is this about what it takes?
Probably will. Okay.
So. Yeah. All right. 2:40. I was just saying. I want to do the converse to the Poincaré lemma today.
Okay.
And as a step in the right direction, we first will look at the generalized Stokes theorem. Let's try a few examples. Integration and integration and differentiation are inverse to one another. So we have something like this from, where do I want to go let's say we do that, then the derivative of that with respect to t is t. I suppose that should be a dummy index here. Integration and differentiation are inverse to one another. Another way to write that is the integral of the differential of a function from a to b is the function at b minus the function at a. So, where this is, the only difference between this and a differential form is that I haven't written the d bold, but they're really the same thing. So, we might as well write the d bold. And now we're keeping track of the direction of integration. We know how to integrate, what would be the next sort of thing. Suppose we have the integral of a curl of a vector. What would it be? Dotted into the normal to some surface over some area. What does that give us? Is this Stokes' theorem?
Yeah, I guess it gives you a second degree problem.
That b dot dl around the boundary. So it's a closed integral. So if this is over some two-dimensional surface, this is over some curve that's the boundary of that surface. Well, this d dot dl, what's d dot dl? You know, in Cartesian coordinates, we've got dx, dx plus dy, dy plus dz, dz. You know, like I said, the things that go under integral signs are differential forms. Well, that's a one form. So, this is the, you know, loop integral of a one form. Around that that boundary curve. What's this look like? What's the curl of 8? We talked about that, and I think I gave it a bit. What's that?
We did that one already.
Yeah. What is it?
Oh, it's the capital P of the 1. No.
It's like D of the 1 form V. So
yeah.
if I call this 1 form, well, let me call it 1 form omega, just so I don't get. So if omega, if I replace this 1 form looking like thing with 1 form omega, then this looks like D of omega integrated over a two-dimensional surface. But D of omega, all right, if omega is V1 dx1, V2 dx2, V3 dx3, or just VI dxI, and we can make that bold if you like. And this is the form. I'm going to stop doing this before too long, but keep that a little bit. Then D omega, look at what it is. It's VI, comma, J, dx, J wedge, dx, I. Look, that's already a two-dimensional integral. That's what we have here. We have a two-dimensional integral. So, the integral of the curl of V dot the normal D2X is just the integral of d omega over some two-dimensional space.
You can put a cross instead of a dot first one there.
Oh, yeah. That's better.
A little different.
Okay. Yeah. These are examples then. So, let's see, what does this end up saying? It says that the integral of d omega over a two-dimensional surface is the same as the integral of omega around the boundary to that surface, the one-dimensional boundary. Let's look at this one. Here we have a one form. If we let omega be df, that's d of a zero form. Sorry, let's just leave it. Df is d of a zero form. So we have the integral of df over some one-dimensional volume is equal to f evaluated at the boundary of a one-dimensional volume is just two points, A and B. So it's really the same thing, only it's a degenerate case on that boundary. It's just two points. But it's a close set, anyway. So you can guess what the generalized Stokes theorem is. You integrate. Let me think whether I want this to be what do I want it to be? Let omega be any p form. There's something to be proved here. Then the integral of d omega over some p plus one-dimensional volume is the same as the integral over the p-dimensional boundary to that volume, which will always be a closed set of omega. That's the generalized Stokes theorem. Let me see if I define that the way I meant to. Let's see. No, didn't. Let me do it this way. Go ahead, P plus one.
Hang on. Yeah, I want omega to be a p form, so.
So that's got to be a p.
No, this is right.
This is right. So the boundary of p plus one dimensional volume is some closed p dimensional surface. All right, so let's try a proof of the general statement. It'll be a little abstract, but brief. You'll see the point anyway. Let's write this out. So we have a p plus one dimensional integral here, but d of a p form I can write as omega I1 through IP, comma, and then the derivative one, let's put a comma j, so that's ddxj. This is summed over all j, and then I1 all wedged with dxit. That's the right-hand side. So that's the integral of d omega over d plus 1. And the point here is that term by term, all right, this is a sum of n terms, right? J is summed from 1 to n. So there's a sum of n terms here, but each term, we can actually do one of the integrals, right? Because this is the derivative, it's just fundamental theorem of calculus. This is the partial of some function with respect to xj integrated over xj. We can do that integral. So, question? Okay. We can write this as a sum on, right, j equals 1 to n. Now, on j only, I'm going to suspend the Einstein convention. So, I'm going to write the sum explicitly here. And the reason is because the limits run from some aj to some bj, and then there remain the integrals over all of the other variables. So, you know, this is the dxj, and then here we have omega I1 through IP, comma, J, DXI1 through DXIP. And notice that these, oh shoot, I've written these in the wrong order. Hang on. Let me flip it. We've got a DXJ here. We have the boundary of the j's coordinate can depend on all of the coordinates of the space you're integrating in. So you're integrating over some volume. You're going to integrate from A to B, but A and B depend on what other coordinate you're integrating on. So, you know, we have some region like this, xj happens to be the coordinate that goes this way, then we're integrating from some aj to some bj here, but that depends on where we are in, you know, the other direction. So this integral needs to be inside the remaining integrals over these p indices, so this is over some p-dimensional volume, but that volume lies at the edge of this region, so let me call it a p-surface, and it's a piece of the boundary of dp plus 1, okay? You know, suppose we have some three-dimensional shape here. Okay, so it's some blob we're integrating over. Then if xj is this way, and we have, you know, two other coordinates, call them x1 and x2, and j happens to be 3 for this integral. Remember, it's a sum over all the different j's. What you're going to get is when you integrate at a particular value here from the bottom of the blob to the top of the blob, you still have a two-dimensional integral to do. You still have the integral in these two dimensions. And let me see if it's clear now. It's clearer if I make it a rectangle. When you study topology, I don't know how many of you have worked your way through Moncrief or something like that, but you find that, you know, any shape can be approximated arbitrarily well by small spheres, or equivalently small cubes in the limit of smaller and smaller cubes. You can write any open set as the sum of spaces, open sets. And those open sets can be as small as you like, so you can make the approximation in the limit of, an open set is the sum of all the open sets it contains. And in fact, it's the union of all of the cubic open sets it contains. So you can always reduce the integral over a volume to an integral over cubes. But to see how this boundary thing is working, imagine our thing is a cube. Then we're going to integrate. So in one term in the sum, we happen to be integrating in this direction. This is, you know, j equals 3. So now when we integrate from down here to up there, we get this thing. All right, these coefficient functions depend on the x's as well. What happens is we get the integrand evaluated at this top plane, and at the bottom plane as we go from A to B. We retain an integral over the bottom and an integral over the top. Then the sum, when j is 2, we get that end surface and this end surface. When j is 1, we get the face here and the face around behind. So we're summing over all of the different faces of that cube in whatever dimension we happen to be in. So we do the integral, and what we get is something that won't fit in that space. I've run out of space. Let me go down here. So we get a sum on j of now the integral over pieces of the boundary, elements of the boundary, del p plus 1. And they are things of the form I1 through IP evaluated at all of the x, except that xj is equal to bj minus the same thing I1 through IP at all x except that xj is evaluated at aj. And then we have all the dx's, dxi1 through dxit, still out there. So we end up with a difference of 2 top and bottom integrals summed over all of the different dimensions of the space, integrated over each one. And that adds up to the closed boundary.
I guess I don't understand why we're not double summing j, because j can still be between 1 and p.
J runs from 1 to n. right? You're going to, it depends how you parameterize your surface. If it's a p-dimensional volume, you might be able to describe it with p-coordinates, and then the form will only depend on those p-coordinates. But in general, think of the surface you were drawing. If you have a function of let me see. How would we define this? Think of a curved surface in a three-dimensional space. All right, the surface is a function of x and y and z. Now you can choose two coordinates u and v that coordinatize that manifold, but if we're embedded in three Euclidean dimensions, it's handy to do the problem in terms of x, y, and z. But the problem can be done either way. We could treat this as some t plus one-dimensional space, and the thing would still hold. But we've defined these forms in n dimensions. And this could, in principle, depend on all n coordinates. And then these sums, these implicit sums that I am using the Einstein summation convention for, they all run from 1 to n. Right, so there could be quite a lot of terms here. How many terms in a general p form? Well, let's n choose p. Right, there are a lot of basis forms for p forms. So it's a big sum. But I think you'll agree, putting the limits of the j coordinate and integrating over all the other orthogonal directions. Gives you the area of the surface in that direction, and then we're adding all of those together. So this is, in fact, the closed surface integral over that surface which is the boundary of the p plus 1. It's some p-dimensional surface. And the thing we're integrating is omega evaluated on that surface only. I'll do some low-dimensional examples, and you'll see a little better how this works. That's the guts of the proof of the general case. You see that you can integrate term by term one integral in each of these terms because you've got exactly one that's a total derivative. Let's in fact look at this. Let's look at the two-dimensional case. It's easier to see there. We can draw a clear picture of everything that's happening, and you will see that this really adds up to the closed boundary. So, any questions before we start that? And you've got the picture? Okay. P equals 0, of course, we have g of a function over some curve. It's a one-dimensional curve. Goes from some point in n dimensions. It could run from some point, vector A to vector B, and the integral of that is f at B minus f at A. And that is, in fact, f integrated over the boundary of this region. Well, this region is a line. The boundary of the line is the two points. So there's no integral to do. It's just a sum. So that one is clear. You just get the two points corresponding to these two terms. That's all we get in that case. When p is 1, there's a little more to do. Now we want to integrate over some surface b of a one-form omega. And let's take the surface. You guys have looked at manifolds. You know that locally a manifold looks Euclidean. So you can divide the manifold up into little infinitesimal squares that look like flat pieces. So let's look at the integral over a flat piece. Let's see. Let me take the corners to be a little more general. So we go from some A and B here. Let's call this, okay, C and B. And we go up here to A and D. And we get up here to C and D. So those are the corners of that little flat cat, which we imagine to be a small piece of a surface. We're going to add together a whole bunch of these. Adding together notice if we've got two little plaquettes that, they don't have to exactly line up, but integrating over the area is just, it's the sum of integrals over each one, so it's really just the sum of a whole bunch of things like that. If our theorem does what we expect, and we have quickly proved that it does, we'll get the integral of the boundary. Well, look at the boundary of a region like this. So we're going to get an oriented integral around the boundary of that one. If we add it to the oriented integral around the boundary of this one, notice that the common sides cancel, and we end up with the boundary of the whole thing. So we can add together little infinitesimal plaquettes to get arbitrary regions of arbitrary shape in arbitrary dimensions. So let's see how this works for this particular thing. Let me just call this X and Y. They'd be more generalized coordinates somewhere in some curved surface, but for our small piece, we can do it that way. So we're going to integrate from, it's really a double integral, and we're going to go from, x is going to run from A to C, and y is going to run from B to D. And what we have is d omega. Well, d omega is omega I comma j dx I wedge dx dx j wedge dx I. Let's see. Since this happens to lie conveniently in the same plane as our coordinate, this turns out to be omega x comma y, make this a y, minus omega y comma x. There's probably a half here. Then dx wedge dy. Or let's see, no, there's not a half. Let me do that explicitly. Sorry. We have 1 comma 2 dx1 wedge dx2. We also have omega 2 comma 1 dx2 wedge dx1. X1 is x, x2 is y, and this is minus that. So I can write this as omega x comma y. Then I pick up a minus sign when I flip these two, omega y comma x, and then we have dx and then dy, like that. So that's what goes in here. So we have two integrals, omega x comma y dx dy, and omega y comma x dx dy. And
why does the wedge product disappear?
I've chosen the sign.
Okay.
All right, so we've got the positive orientation here doing x and y.
Okay.
I think, let me see. Yeah, leave it at that. Yeah, in general, you know, going between a volume form in forms and a volume form is like the usual, calculus notation, DNX. You can do it using the Hodge dual too. There's a way to write out that equivalence that way. But we've kept the orientation here. You know, that minus sign is telling us what we've chosen for the orientation. So now we can do one of each of these integrals. So in the first integral, we can do the y integral. So what we get is the integral, all right, we're left with the x limits from a to c. And what we get is omega x, and omega x is a function of x, but we've integrated y from up to d, and then we have omega x still dependent on x, but subtracting the value with d. That's the first term. We get two terms. Then here, we subtract the integral, and now it'll be b to d. We're going to do the x integral first. Or we're going to do the x integral. That's the one we can do. And we'll have omega y, and now it'll be a c, and still a general y, to be integrated dy, minus omega y at a, and general y, also dy. This is all still dx up here. Now, look at what each of these four terms is. Right, I want to write a final form for this. Well, okay, first we're integrating the x component dx. Notice that where can I write it here? Omega is equal to omega x dx plus omega y dy. Okay, so these are, you know, something like this plus something like that, you know, looks very much like we're integrating omega. Well, in fact, what we're integrating here is omega, where we're only varying x. So we're doing an integral this way. Dy is zero. We're holding y constant here. So we're integrating omega x over dx at d. So here's d, here's c, here's a, I'm sorry, this is b here, and this is c. So we're at d. So we're integrating this way, positive direction. So you see the orientation will emerge here. Probably backwards. but we're integrating in the positive x direction along that top part of the curve. That's unambiguous here. But notice that what we are integrating here, that first term from a to c can be written as omega. At general x and d constant. If d is constant, this term drops out, and you just get the first one. So integrating general omega, but with d held constant, you only have to integrate that term. Then let's look out here at c. That would be this term. There's a minus sign. So we're integrating in the negative y direction here. And what we're integrating is the y component. We're holding x constant. So this term is the same as integrating omega from, cd to cb. Now, here, d going to b, I can write plus because the negative sign is in these limits. Here we were going, let me be more explicit here. We started up here, so we're going from ad to cd there. So a going to c tells us that's that direction, the direction and then the limit. So just integrating omega. Then the next term is at b, which is this one, it's negative. So once again, y is held constant, so omega reduces to just this. And we're integrating from CB to AB. And the fact that we go from C to A is what tells us that we're now going this way. I mean, you see what's happening here. We're getting our closed integral. Finally, we're going to go from AB to AD where we started. That's the only term that's left. What is it? We're holding A constant. That's this term. Wait, is it? Yeah, we're integrating dy. No. What's wrong?
Something's wrong. That's A constant.
A is constant. So we're going from B to D. Oh, two minus. I didn't see this one.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's plus. Okay, so omega. And that is precisely the integral of omega around that closed curve.
This should be like a bracket around an integrand.
Yeah. Okay, that helps. There we go.
Okay. Get rid of the dy, too.
No!
You gotta go over there. Sounds like me sometimes.
Remember Mr. Pill.
Mr. Pill!
You don't remember Mr. Pill. Never mind. Okay, you see how it works. And that last branch, of course, is going back up here. With the positive sign. And so, you know, it all comes together.
A good exercise? 2p equals 2.
Right? Integrate over a little cube. So, where can I write that? Yeah.
Exercise. I know you got the exercises from last time on the phone. I didn't have them written down.
I'll get them up. Let's see. It's tomorrow, I think, probably. I'm not sure I'll have time this evening. But I've got them. I just got them this morning. That's the pictures. And I draw the... Yeah, it's important that I write these on the board and then you take a picture of them because then I transcribe them to the problem page. So, yeah, do this for p equals 2. So do a little cube. And, you know, you can argue that if you do two little adjacent cubes, all right, you've got two cubes like this, and you know they're all oriented. So you know it's all outward orientation. Sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
It said orient volume. Ugh.
Oh, ugh. Yeah, ugh.
But this
common boundary, one is out that way, the other's out that way. You know, some right-hand or left-handed rule, depending on how badly you muck it up. They'll cancel, though, when you add those together. So, integrating over the whole volume is equivalent to integrating omega over the whole surface. And you can see that the surfaces that you get this way really are compact. You know, they're nice, contained sets. Okay. Question? Generalized Stokes theorem.
Do you need to have it in a definite integral, or can these be indefinite
integrals? For indefinite integrals, you're probably taking the boundaries you see off at infinity. I mean, they're often used this way with, say, the divergence theorem in, you know, Gauss's law or something.
Okay.
And if you know your field spans at infinity, you just throw out the surface term. Right. So you can use these for
but then you have to watch out for signs.
Yeah, you want to get your sign right. Well, zeros, the sign is not a problem. But often in field theory, well, when we vary an action, right, we're always throwing out a surface term. And when you do the same kind of thing in field theory, vary a field action, it's very common to assume that you're dealing with some field that vanishes off at infinity, and
you integrate over all space, then you get to throw out the surface for that reason. But you can just as well integrate over a finite volume and say the variation vanishes at the boundary of that volume. You'll still get your field equation. So, you know, a lot of things that might seem to just hold for convex sets, you can do them by piecing together as many open sets as you like. Question?
Yeah, and I'm probably just missing something that we went over the first day or something like that. We're taking the one form R d omega, and we're setting it equal to, you know, our double integral. Then we split it up into x and y components. Okay.
Right. So
is that
omega is the one form, d omega is the two form.
Okay.
So when you take d of a one form, so if I've got a one form omega, right, then when I take d of it, what that means is I take d of that function. D of a function is the gradient with a dx. So I get, for each of these functions, omega I get the xj derivative together with an xj, and I wedge that with the previous one here. So it becomes a two-form. This is anti-symmetric, so it imposes the anti-symmetry here, and this is a sum over all I and all j, which in our case was just 1 to 2.
Right.
So because of the anti-symmetry, there only end up being two terms. You get a 1, 2, or a 2, 1. Okay, so I've explicitly written out the sum in that formula. Yeah. And, you know, secretly there, you know, at some point you can drop the wedge and discuss what your orientation is. I'm not sure why that came up. Yeah, usually you get a right-handed thing.
Into the board.
Oh, X, Y, yeah, Z is out this way. Why didn't this end up going around the other way, I wonder? It's something about my convention for the exterior derivative. That may be it. Some people will put this dx at the end. You may see that in some text. Okay. So when you take d of some form, you could get omega I1 through IP, comma j, dx I1 through wedge dx IP, and then you wedge the dxj on this end. And that probably, that may give you the right hand.
Yeah, it'll give you.
Yeah, that would certainly do it in this case. There's a minus sign there. That's probably why my orientation is non-standard. I choose to put the dx in front because it turns out to be necessary to do it that way when you do supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is you have fermionic numbers, you have anti-commuting numbers that you're working with. And to keep the signs straight, you require a more rigid convention. And you want to put the differentials on the left when you're doing a D there. So I've just gotten in the habit of defining it this way all the time. But that's probably what mucked up my orientation. So you'll see it defined the other way in some books, no doubt.
So you're doing left-hand.
Yeah, this is an orientation for the left-hand side. Okay, next step is the converse to the Poincaré lemma. So I want to use the generalized Stokes theorem to prove the converse to the Poincaré. Any Doctor Who fans in the crowd? Yeah, they moved again.
TV show.
Right. Jake knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's this episode of Doctor Who where there are these stone statues and sort of grotesque, you know, angelic things. Well, they're angels, except that they're actually some sort of very slow-moving aliens. And they're slow-moving, except if you're not watching. So, you know, here's this angel, and then you blink, and it's coming at you with fangs and stuff. You know, television, well. So, you know, you have to watch these all the time, because if you blink, they're closer and coming after you. I don't know why Doctor Who, which is really good science fiction, has degenerated into sort of a horror movie, but anyway, there was that episode, and I've decided that that's what these erasers are doing. You know, if you blink, you know, if you find they've all migrated up or down the board, usually that way. They're trying to escape. So, the converse of the Poincaré lemma.
This might prove why erasers move direct.
Let's do the Poincaré lemma first. Just remind you.
Wheeler's law. Erasers always move towards the nearest door.
E squared equals zero. We can state that as the exterior derivative of the omega is equal to zero. Always. For any omega. There's some terminology that I should mention here. A form omega is closed if d omega equals zero, and a form omega is exact if omega is d of some other form. So we can state that Poincaré, the Poincaré lemma, we can say that d of an exact form vanishes terminology. We'll run into this, or I'll say it inadvertently sometimes, so I might as well tell you what it means. That's what it means. Now, the converse suppose we can say this even better, an exact form is closed. So if we have a form that's d of something, then d of it is zero, because d squared is zero. Right, so the converse is a closed form is exact. And there's a caveat on the truth of this. This is true in a star-shaped region. All right. By a star-shaped region, imagine standing at some point in the middle of a region. It's star-shaped if you can see every point of the region. So, it can have it can go out and stuff, but it can't go around corners. You know, you can have stuff like this. So from a point here, I can see every point of this region, and you know, I could make it a pointed star, You know, so here's where the nomenclature comes from. I can still see every point of that, but not star-shaped. If we have to go around corners. So, you know, here we get, you know, this is starting off nicely star-shaped or something. It doesn't have to be a star, but now we have a corner that goes down this way, and that's bad. You know, this bit over here won't work because you can't see where you're going.
So there has to be some point where you can see where it is.
Yeah. This is actually, it's a topological condition. You know, you'd like to be integrating in some region that's basically isomorphic to Rn. That, you know, a nice open set without multiple connectedness. You can get in trouble in two ways. Let me tell you how this term works. Let me write a little more about the setup of what we have to show, and then I'll tell you where it can go bad. There are two ways it can go bad. One of them has to do with the region, and the other has to do with it being closed. So, for proof, we need to show that if a form omega is closed, if d omega equals zero, then there exists eta such that omega is d of eta. So, in fact, it's exact. Now, the way to prove it is to construct eta. What we want to do is let eta... Alright, just use the fundamental theorem of calculus. We're going to integrate one dimension of this thing. So, let eta be integral along some curve of omega. In here, of omega. All right. Then, if eta is well defined, then clearly we have d of eta is omega. So we've got what we want. The question is, when is this integral well defined? That raises the question, well, what does it mean for an integral to be well-defined? An integral along a curve is well-defined if it is single-valued. Right? So, if we take two different curves, for this, eta must be single-valued. Okay, so what we have to have is that the integral of omega along C must be true and only if that integral is independent of the curve C. So here's a picture. You know, we're in some, you know, n dimensions. We've got some point A down here, and we're gonna define eta to be the integral along whatever curve from our initial point A up to a final point X. And if you get different values for that when you take a different curve, then you don't have a unique assignment eta of x. You know, this is a functional, not a function. It needs to be a function of position. Or, you know, it's a p-form, so, you know, some n choose p functions of position, not functional. Good? So...
Those fields must be conservative.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you get this. This is exactly what happens with a force in Newtonian physics. Right. Only conservative forces have potentials. The potential is the integral of the force. That integral is only single value. You know, along a curve, f dot dx along a curve gives the potential, but the integrability condition that makes it unique is that it's the same along any two paths, which amounts to the curl of the force vanishing. So a curl-free force will have a potential. Well, that's exactly what we're going to get because we're going to use Stokes' theorem. Here's how it goes. So we define A to be that integral, and we demand that this be single valued. So if we go along C1 from A to X, omega, that has to be the same as going along any C2 from A to X. And if we so call that C1, call that C2. So these are, of course, oriented integrals. That's a form, and we're integrating one of the P dx's along the curve. Take the difference of these. So this means that the integral is from A to X along C1 minus C2 of omega has to be zero. So if the integral along these two is the same, then if we go up C1 and back down C2, we've done a closed loop. So we get that for all closed curves, integral of omega equals zero. So we use the generalized Stokes in one dimension. We're only doing a one-dimensional integral here, but this is a curve, but it applies. What we get is 0 is equal to this closed integral of omega is equal to the integral over any surface such that C is the boundary of the surface. Well, there are lots of choices for that surface. So any surface with that boundary, and then the boundary is arbitrary, so really anywhere we want to integrate, we now have a two-dimensional integral of d omega. The only way that the integral of d omega can vanish for every possible surface is if d omega itself is zero. So the local condition for integrability is that this integral will be single-valued provided, all right, in fact, always except for if and only if d omega equals zero, so if omega is closed. So if omega is closed, this function is single-valued, but this function is such that d of it is our original omega, and we've proved the theorem. Caveat, there's another way for this to go bad. Suppose we have a hole here in our manifold. If we have something multiply connected, you're adding different roots to the same point. So, on a sphere, say, I can go to the North Pole this way, but I can also come around to the South Pole, or a torus, I can wrap around many times before I get there. And that class of paths can't be deformed to just a straight line path. So you run into topological issues if you get away from simple regions, what are called star-shaped regions. That's the reason for this, to be sure that you don't run into topological obstructions to getting single valuedness. So now we get the converse to the Poincaré lemma. And this is a very, very useful thing. It tells us when we can integrate a form. Well, we're going to write some differential equations with forms. So this is a really, really useful tool for figuring out when a set of equations are integrable, when you can actually go through and find a solution to some equation. If you've written it as d omega equals stuff, then the condition that the equation be integrable just follows from Poincaré and the converse. Let me give you an example of this. Let's see. I have to think whether this is... quite fair yet. You remember we talked last time about the Bianchi identities in general relativity. We will see, I won't do it now, but we will see that the Bianchi identities are simply integrability conditions for the modified equations written down. Here's the thing we'll do. We'll write some differential equations that describe a group, describe a Lie group. And those are guaranteed to have a solution because of the properties of Lie algebras. We'll see all this in detail. But then we're going to modify the equations. And modifying them means they're not exactly solved, so you add some stuff to the equation to compensate. But then you're going to put some restrictions on that stuff. And now you want to know if the equations are integrable, so you check the integrability. And the stuff you've added are the curvatures, and the integrability conditions are the Bianchi identities. It comes out very cleanly, and we'll work through it. So, there we go. Neil tells me I need to go sign some papers across campus, so I don't want to stay too late here. Do you want to embark on the wedge product, on the Hodge dual today?
Or just to see what it is, just because it's the last of our three things. But I don't know. How about you guys?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Absolutely fine. Let's go. All right.
So, interested in what it is.
Yeah. Let's get it out there, and we'll do more examples of that. Let's see. I guess. Let's see. Let me try and dream up an example of an integrability condition. Suppose, I don't know if this will work, I'm just trying to invent something off the top of my head. So, suppose we have df is equal to some function h dx plus
Well, okay, here's a very easy one.
You can do it in your head now, but when is this integrable? Okay, what condition can you find that will guarantee that you can integrate that equation? Right. This is the system think of h is a function of x and y, f is a function of x and y, right, that's f. So what this is, the x component of this is df dx is h. The y component of this is df dy is 1. Okay, so we're talking about this system of partial differential equations. When is that integrable? It's very easy to find by applying the Poincaré lemma here.
Okay, so do it, and you'll get some condition.
It'll be a simple condition. If you like that one, I'll make up some more.
I don't understand that question. It seems like the answer would be whenever H is integrable. Whenever the function of H. So that's not a very good answer.
Let's see. There's a very specific constraint on the derivatives of H,
right,
that has to be satisfied. Okay. Do you know what to do? Use the Poincaré lemma.
So you say if you use the Poincaré lemma and that equals zero, then we know it's integrable, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Let me try and say how it applies there. Okay.
Yeah.
We're saying that this one form is equal to that. That's exact. So, what's that mean? Exact. If this is exact, then it has to be closed. It's exact if and only if it's closed. So that's not obviously an exact form. And it's not always. It's not an exact form for all functions H. Only for certain functions H to satisfy a simple condition that you'll find if you demand that that be closed. So, you know what to do.
I think so.
Take B as a thing. Sorry. And you'll get a condition, and that's the condition. Okay. So, the Hodge tool. All right, this is denoted by a star applied to a p-form. And star is a mapping that takes p-forms to n minus p-forms. What you're really doing here is, anytime you've got a p-form, it's talking about some p-dimensional volume. Right, if you wanted to integrate it, you'd integrate over p dimensions. The Hodge dual gives you the orthogonal subspace. Right, there's some n minus p dimensional orthogonal space. The Hodge dual gives you a mapping between objects on those two spaces. They're in one-to-one correspondence. Notice that the dimension of lambda p, you found this, it's n choose p. And that's n factorial over p factorial n minus p factorial. Whereas the dimension of lambda n minus p is n choose n minus p. And that's n factorial over n minus p factorial p factorial. Those are the same. They have the same number of degrees of freedom, so it's not too surprising to find that there's a one-to-one map between them. And so the Hodge dual is that map. And it exists, its existence depends on the existence of the Levi-Civita tensor.
That is the Hodge dual similar or the same as the star on in psi star?
Psi, no, that's a complex conjugate.
Okay.
That's another kind of duality. Dualities are things that if you apply them twice, they come back to where you were. So, it's a dual. If being a dual means the star one.
Okay.
Right. So complex conjugation is the same way. You take the complex conjugate twice.
I think it was the dual thing that was
getting back where you
gave me the dual.
There are lots of kinds of duals, and they can be very useful. So this is between subspaces, it's a mapping between two equal dimensioned vector spaces. The Levi-Civita tensor. Let's see, we have this anti-symmetric symbol, I1 through IN. It's totally anti-symmetric on N indices, so it's unique up to an overall multiple. And for an overall multiple, we use the square root of the determinant of the metric. So the Hodge dual, you'll notice, depends on the metric. So where G is the determinant of the metric, the metric tensor. We saw last time that, what did we see about this? It's actually, for Lorentz transformations where the determinant of the metric at absolute value 1, the tensor is invariant. It's not coordinate invariant. This is a rank n tensor. So this E object, by virtue of having the root G in there, epsilon is a tensor density. Root G is a tensor density of the opposite weight. So in fact, you know, this thing is really and truly a tensor. Okay. In fact, if you change coordinates on it, you just get the same expression with G in the new coordinates. And, you know, the sort of determinant will be different in different coordinate systems. Cartesian coordinates is 1, spherical coordinates is r squared, you know, what was the determinant of the metric is, what, r4 sine squared theta. Square root of it is r squared sine theta. So we've looked at a few examples of that sort of thing. So the dual of a P form is just sort of a messy thing to deal with, but here we go. If omega is a P form, then star of omega is given in the following way. There's going to be a coefficient. I'll tell you what it is in a minute. Actually, it's n minus p factorial. I'll tell you a simple way to remember it. Then you take the coefficients of this form, omega I1 through IP. Remember, that's totally anti-symmetric. So if I raise p indices on this tensor, and contract them, then I have I p plus 1 through I n. It always has n indices in n dimensions that I can put dx's on. All right, now, there are n minus p of these, and that's why we need this factor up front here. Let me define this. Let's see, do I want to do it? Now, let's just leave it that way. I'm sorry. You know, let me go ahead and
put my normalization in here. So I could have 1 over p factorial here, in which case I get a p factorial there, too. That just comes along. That p factorial is part of this coefficient. So that defines the dual. So let's compute star of omega. There's a hairy one. Let's not go there yet. The problem is, you do a star twice, and so let's just note that this depends on something like we're going to have epsilon I1 through IP, IP plus 1 through IN, and then we're going to do it again, so we're going to have EIP plus 1 through IN, we need T of these, J1 through JT, so this has a total of N indices, DX J1 through DX JT, and the problem is this can be written as a multi-index Kronecker, I1 through IP, J1 through JP, times some coefficient that I don't remember. And it takes a little work to figure it out. I've got it on my wall in my office, but, it's in n dimensions, this is a messy number to figure out. It's just some combinatoric factorial stuff. Right? It's not that bad, but, where this thing is defined as a bunch of anti-symmetrized Kronecker deltas. So you do a full anti-symmetrization on one of those sets. So there are p factorial terms in that thing, and then to find lambda, you've got to take a trace over p different things, where p could be anything up to 762. Jake?
So am I saying this right in thinking that for each index we raise, we're adding a d to that?
Yeah, exactly. There are p metrics that we use. Yeah, exactly.
So in order to calculate this thing, it's a really big, hairy, ugly mess.
Often not quite that bad.
Okay.
It certainly is more difficult than the wedge or the D,
right?
The exterior derivative. So you do a little bit of mucking around. So for a practice with this, let's let N equal 3 and write some forms and find their dual. Okay, so exercise, it's not bad if N equals 3. So let's do a bunch of practice with that. What happens is, let's keep the metric general. Okay. Let the metric be GIJ. So it's some 3x3 symmetric matrix, and that's all we really need to know about it. Let's see what I can ask you to do here. F be a function, omega be a one form, eta be some two form, and tau be some three form. Find their dual. A little more challenging. Let's see here. What's that? Just carry this function along. You may have some factors of root g in your expression. Okay. Find f ** omega ** theta and ** tau. So go with like A and B. And note, all right, here's the thing you need. E, I, J, K, it's only got three indices, times E, L, M, N is Kronecker, I, L, J, M, K, N, totally anti-symmetrized, times some factor, and we'll find the factor here in just a minute. So, J, L, K, M, I, N plus delta K, L, I, M, J, N minus delta J, L, delta I, M, delta K, N. Now cycle those top ones. I, L, K, M, creeping eraser, J, N, and finally delta K, L, J, M, I, N. Okay, and now to figure out what constant goes here, I'm going to suppose L, M, and N equal I, J, K respectively. Then this side becomes 6, 3 factorial. It's just, there are only 6 non-zero entries in epsilon. Let's see, I should add that epsilon I, J, K is 1 over root determinant of the metric times this anti-symmetric symbol up or down. So, here, the root g cancels between these two, so it's just a pure number. On this side, if L, M, N equal I, J, K, this first term is what? If this is I, that's J, that's K, what do I get? 27. 27. 3
squared. Oh,
3 squared. Okay, so this is I, J, K, so I get a delta J, N, delta K, K, that one gives me 3. Let's see, this is I, J, K, so I get K, M, this one becomes, I get K, J, with J, K, that one becomes 3. Then here, if this becomes I, J, K, then we have, this is the delta J, J, that's 3, this is K, K, so this one becomes 6, a minus 6. Here, I, J, K, we have an I. I is 3, and then these two cross and give us another minus 6. And this one does the same thing. I, J, and K, here we get 3. Those two cross and give us a minus 6. So what we have is 27 plus 6 minus 18. What is that? Let's see, so 27 minus 12 is 15, is that right?
Yes.
15. So the trace of all that is 15. Where did that come from? That must be some combinatory.
One of them.
So this has to be 6 over 15 out here.
15 comes from 6, What? It was like 664 or something.
What is it? Yeah, let's see. If we've got 2, 3, 4, 5, then let's see. The factorials are 1, 2, 6, 24, 120. That one divided by 15, how many? 6 times? So 5 factorial over 3 factorial? Is that right? 1, that's 30 times 2 factorial. So why did we get that?
15 is 1 for sure, I don't know.
So 5 factorial is 120. No, wait, did I do that wrong? That's not right. 2 times 6. Hang on. So I'm going to get 15. If I divide by 3 factorial, 6 into that, that's 20. That's not right. No, okay. That's just as well. If I divide by 4. Okay, so... I'm not seeing where these numbers are coming from, but 5 factorial over
2. Do you have your notes on which one was 15?
Yeah.
One of them is 15 for sure.
Yeah.
Which one is it? Let's see. Six, six, four.
664. So 6 is 720. And so 6 factorial over 4 factorial, 2 factorial is 720 over 24 times 2 is 15. Yeah, that's right. So that's what the prefactor is. Not obvious to me why it is that, but there's some reason. And you can figure out what it has to be in general, and there's some perfectly sensible reason for it, but it's tricky to figure. But anyway, that's what this constant here is. So we need 6 15ths out front, and now that identity will. You know, you can trace this on 1 or 2 or 3 indices, and, you know, you get other identities from it. So if there's one sum, if k equals n, just set k equals n in each term, and you get something just involving 2 Kronekers, a much simpler formula. If 2 of these are the same, you'll get a single Kroneker, presumably with a 2 in front of it, right? So in particular, up on I, J, K... or E, M, J, K. All right, if I trace I, M, I get 6 over here, so I need 2 times the Kronecker I, M. I trace that, and I get 6 over there. So setting 2 of these the same, you'll derive that identity. So you can get all the identities you need from just this one. It's just a matter of taking some traces. But I think we probably did that 6 15ths right, so... That reduces to what? 3? Oh, what's it?
3 fifths.
2. 2 fifths. Maybe 2 fifths is easier. I don't see why, but. 2 times 4 over 5. I don't see why you get 5 and 6 factorial here, but. That's what it appears to be. Okay, so work through just taking the dual of everything in sight in 3 dimensions and taking the double dual and seeing that you come back. You might get a minus sign on some of these. It depends on your conventions. I'm not sure if I've defined it. So they all come out +1. Some might come out -1. Yeah.
6 is the top number over here, too. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, 6 is easy. That's a 3 factorial. You're not ever surprised to see a 3 factorial.
Well, no, the 6 here and then the 6 there. You've got a 6 here and a 6 factorial there.
Yeah, but why is 6 factorial? We get a 6 here because it's 3 factorial, not because there are 6 of anything. Of course, there are 6 terms, but That doesn't explain it. That's some subtler accounting thing. And if you're convinced that you figured out where that comes from, then try it in N dimension.
I'm not convinced. I'm figuring anything out. I'm
all right. But you see how you get it. So any questions on this? Any questions on the problem? Any questions on hot fuel?
Well, a few actually.
Good.
The E on the top one, the double dual, I guess, the more hot fuel. You have the subscript E I one E I P.
Where am I looking here?
On the line where it says note. Subscript.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
A little the E expression.
Yes.
What is the subscript I one P? That?
So here.
Yeah.
Okay. I've used P factors of the metric to raise the first P indices of this. Mm-hmm. So this is the one with all the indices down. It's this thing, but the first P indices have been raised with the metric. Clear?
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, there are a bunch of metrics in this. Now we've
raised and lowered indices some before, so hopefully can just keep up with it.
Yeah. But yes, the Hodge dual requires the metric. This is actually something that's very interesting that comes up in our research. There's in these conformal gauge theories we look at, there's a second way to define a dual that does not depend on the metric. And that could prove to be really interesting. It's independent of, as long as you're working in canonically conjugate coordinates, it's independent of the metric. If you change one coordinate without changing the other, you're in a phase space type place, and the two offset each other. It's really kind of cool how it happens. But we might be able to look at that later on. We'll see how far we get. We're moving along nicely now.
It's like we never stopped in London.
All of vector calculus in 3 days in n dimensions. Not bad. What we can now do, and if you are bored around noon Sunday, have a half a day to muck about, the next thing I'm going to assign you to do is to start combining these things. So D and wedge and star, what do they do if you mix them up? If you take star and D or D and star, what kind of things do you get? And you'll find that, or we'll see next week, that you can construct some very familiar objects that way. Divergence, grad, curl, all of those things. Having the Hodge dual lets us, in three dimensions, the Hodge dual, notice, it maps one form to two forms, or it maps two forms to one form. One forms are vectors. So now d omega, which is a two form, can be turned back into a vector using the Hodge dual, and that's what the curl is. Right? So the curl is a special case of the Hodge dual combined with an exterior derivative. And we'll go through a bunch of examples of that and talk more about it. So I've got to run across campus and sign some paper or other. I should do it with my mucky hands here. I should scare them.
Great.
I'm all set to go. somebody's thesis or promotion papers, All right. Good. Any other questions? Did you have more?
Yeah,
questions are nice. We've got time for some questions.
I have just a quick question related to this. Should that omega be down, or transform with the opposite sign, and the omega be up?
you just run it through that structure equation for that one?
Sure. So you've got a fix. You know what the transformation of the vial vector is.
Right. Right. Exactly. Just plug it in.
Put that in and see what sign.
And you'll see it's the opposite.
The omega is on the opposite side of omega down and omega up in the structure equations. That's what does it. By the time you flip it to the right position, you get it right. Sure. Okay.
Well, I'll show you.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah.
Question was, in here, in this case, we have upper rotation and lower rotation.
Uh-huh.
In this case, we have upper and lower rotation.
Yeah.
So they're not affected the same.
Okay. If I lower I here, then this becomes GIL. This becomes GIN.
Okay.
Did everyone see that? You might need that. So, here we've got mixed positions, and we've raised the index, but if you need a mixed position, okay, just lower the I with a metric. What does that do? It hits the chronicer, and you get a G sub IL here. It hits this I, you get a G sub IN here. So this formula can be written with metrics and chronicers if you mix these positions up.
Oh, boy.
You still get a manageable expression, something that you'll be able to use. So you can raise and lower indices.
But if a metric hits
every... It's a tensor relation.
Okay.
Metric's
going to hit every single term.
Every I. You get a GIN here, you get a GIL here, you get a GIN there.
Oh, I see.
If you lower all three, then all of these become G.
Oh.
And everything's down. Right. So you can put those index positions anywhere you need them.
Right. Okay. Do the tensor and down.
Yeah. And this will be good practice with that too.
This way and that way.
Okay. Good.
Kind of excited for
this. Yeah. I'm afraid to touch this thing. Especially with my fingers in the state they're in. I'm not sure there are buttons all over it.
I might push something.